This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our guest is Billy Joe Armstrong. In 2004, his punk pop band Green Day released a Grammy-winning album called American Idiot. Instead of looking inward for material, as he did on earlier albums, with songs about his anxiety, relationships, and panic attacks, Armstrong wrote about politics, specifically the alienation and anger he felt during the presidency of George W. Bush. An adaptation of the punk rock opera, as the album was called, opened on Broadway last year, earning a Tony nomination for Best Musical. American Idiot has virtually no dialogue. The story is told mostly through songs and choreography. New York Times theater critic Christopher Isherwood wrote that the show, quote, remains for me the most exciting and moving new musical on Broadway, a potent fable about growing up in a distracted and disappointed America. For selected performances this month and next, Billy Joe Armstrong will be on stage with the show in the role of St. Jimmy. Terry spoke with Billy Joe Armstrong last year. Before we hear their conversation, let's start with Green Day's version of American Idiot, followed by the version on the new Broadway cast recording, which features singers from the show accompanied by Green Day.
Billy Joe Armstrong, welcome to Fresh Air. So you play on the soundtrack of the Broadway cast recording, but the cast sings. What would you say are the main differences between the Broadway versions of your songs and your versions?
Oh, you know, I mean, it goes from a three-piece band to a 20-piece vocal ensemble. You know, when we did the album the first time around, it was like me, Mike Dirnt, and Trey Cool doing everything. And then this time it was, you know, dealing with the string section and dealing with how all the characters were kind of coming out, and as far as the play or the musical, if you will, were involved.
One difference I've noted is I think the Broadway singers enunciate more clearly than you
that
do.
Was a big that was a big deal when we're, you know, being a rock singer, I can get away with a lot, you know, because most of the time people don't know what the hell you're saying anyway. That's why we have lyric sheets, you know.
And there's a long tradition of that in rock.
Yeah. And then, but the tradition, you know, we were in the studio with Michael Mayer and
he's
and
the
Tom
director.
Kitt.
Yeah.
Who's the director, and Tom Kitt's the arranger. And when they were listening to the singers, they were saying things like, you know, can you please, I can't hear the T in this particular word, and we're looking, you know, like I can hear it fine, you know, it's no, you know, but that's just the difference between theater people and rock people, I guess.
I bet no one has ever said to you, I can't hear the T.
Yeah, no, I don't think so.
So the songs in American Idiot are rooted in part in the Bush administration era, and I'm wondering what performing for you was like then. Particularly performing songs from American Idiot.
I think I felt a sense of empowerment. I think I was, you know, in the beginning, you know, right after, you know, 9/11, and then watching sort of the tanks going into Iraq, and everything sort of, you know, these embedded journalists, you know, going in, you know, live. It felt like a cross between it was a cross between war and reality television. And so I just felt this like great sort of confusion, and I was like, someone needs to say something. I don't really know you know, I don't know how it's going to come out, but, it, you know, whatever it has to be, it's got to be something very bold and get someone's attention immediately. Because if you're so distracted, you know, by what's going on and on television, you're just watching it. It's like but in reality, what you're doing is you're sitting there on the couch and just sort of seeing the world unfold and explode and lives being lost right in front of your very eyes. So for me, it was just I've kind of felt this moment of just it was like rage and patriotism, I guess you'd want to call it that. And I just wanted to write something that was you know, it just felt very natural. That song wrote itself in probably 30 seconds.
I want to play another song from American Idiot, and this is Holiday. Would you put this song in the context of what you've been talking about politically?
Yeah. You know, it's when I think of Holiday, it's like fragments of sort of political confusion. And it takes the English language and kind of – it's like – it goes against, you know, using English words against itself or something, you know, especially like Sieg Heil or the President Gasman, which actually was German also. But it's kind of another one. Like it was sort of after the song American Idiot, then doing Holiday, I felt even more empowered to write something like that.
So here's Holiday from the Green Day album American Idiot. That's Holiday from the Green Day album American Idiot. And, of course, now there's a Broadway musical called American Idiot featuring the songs from the album. American Idiot is in part about the anger and discontent of young people entering the larger world. And in the Broadway show, it's also about, you know, one of the characters having to fight in Iraq. How far away does that part of your life seem when you were in your teens or early 20s finding your place in the world?
For me, I mean, the first time that you escape from home or the small town that you live in or whatever, you know, there's a reason why a small town is called a small town is because not that many people really want to live there. So to try to get out and see something more and, you know, for me, I had a place called Gilman Street and it was a club, a punk rock club in Berkeley. And I was just introduced to a lot of new ideas. And
so that was your escape?
I think that was my escape, and there was this sort of feeling of like I felt – there was another moment in time where I felt empowered and because I was getting an education that I wasn't really getting being at home anymore or from the schools that I had to go to. It was sort of this feeling of just like, oh, I'm out of prison, you know. But in the musical, there's a lot of the guy Johnny, Jesus of Suburbia, you know, as he's finding this sort of self-righteousness, he ends up – finding sort of some self-destruction, and I think those are the bumps in the road that you take, because you have to take bruises as you get older or coming of age.
There's a lot of anger in the songs in American Idiot. I assume anger is an emotion that you're familiar with. So
yeah.
When you were a teenager, what was generating most of the anger?
Feeling lost. I always say that in every song I write, whether it's a love song or it's a political song or it's, you know, something or a song about family, the one thing that I find is feeling lost and trying to find your way. I think a song like American Idiot, it's a series of questions. You know, I think Holiday is a series of questions. It's like you're trying to battle your way out of your own ignorance. And that's where it's personal. It's like, you know, I don't want to be an American idiot. What I want to be is I'm not sure. I just want more. And I'm willing to take the risk to try to get out of that, you know, or to try to find something more. So that's – I don't know. So it's just kind of loss and trying to dig your way through all the sort of, you know, the mental wrecking yard, I guess.
I know your father died when you were young. How old were you?
10.
And he had cancer of the esophagus. Did that contribute to you feeling lost, do you think?
I think so. I mean, I think it went, you know, beyond that. You know, I remember I was always the kid that got lost in, like, the shopping mall, or, like, I got lost in Santa Cruz,
really?
Walking the boardwalk when I was, like, 5 or 6. I was always just daydreaming constantly, and I still am. You know, I have a lousy sense of direction in so many different ways. And, you know, I think losing someone, you know, that young it's hard because, like, when you deal with death, like, when you lose someone when you're young and you're dealing with death, you suddenly realize that death is a part of life. So when death comes knocking again at a certain time, or if it's a friend or a loved one, it's like you start to not get used to it. You know, you just see it, and when you see it over and over again, you just realize, like, that it, like I said before, it's a part of life. But it's hard because you see a very strong, strong-willed man. It's like you see him crumble within a matter of 3 months. It's like, you know, it's the beginning of summer, and then by the end of the summer, it's a completely different person. And then they're reading his last rites to him. So it's just a lot to take in. You know, I worried about my mother. I worried about a lot of things that I think. It's unfair for kids to worry about, because you have to man up, and for a 10-year-old to man up on something like that and sort of, you know, my brother was 13, he had to man up too, and it was you know, that's a really young age for someone to sort of have to grow up very, very quickly.
So it's interesting, you know, that you discovered punk and it meant so much to you. So once you got deep into punk, did that also bring on any kind of, like physical transformation, just in terms of how you wanted to look physically and what kind of, like, attitude you wanted to present to the outside
right.
world?
I think so. You know, I mean, there was definitely – it wasn't really a dress code. I think at the time when I was getting into punk, there wasn't really – I think the uniform was gone, you mm-hmm. know, in the mm-hmm. scene. You know, I mean, I wore stuff that my dad wore as a truck driver. You know, I mean, I wore Dickies and Ben Davis shirts and derby jackets and flipped up baseball caps and Chuck Taylors and with a, you know, a pile of bleach on top of your head. You know, it was you know, you went around and you borrowed eyeliner from girls that were around the scene at the time, and it was. It was just, you know, it wasn't really a dress code. I mean, that was just what we were into in the punk community, you know.
So you mentioned that you would borrow eyeliner from the girls. Why couldn't you buy it? Why'd you have to borrow it?
I think it was just good conversation, you know. you know, it was, I think that's sort of almost where it came from. You know, there were the girls that were around. I mean, it, you know, I think a lot of women like to see what guys look like dressed up like women. So, you know, or just put makeup on them or whatever, you know. So it was just kind of a fun little activity, and I think it just sort of stuck throughout the years.
So some of your songs are also about psychological issues. Like one song mentions Soda Pop and Ritalin. There's the song Basket Case, the song Give Me Novocaine. And I'm wondering, like, how much of that is about you, if you were, like, medicated at all or in therapy or told you should be in therapy when you were in your teens, in school?
Not so much. I think I try to mix humor with mental health. You know, a song like Basket Case is sort of about panic attacks and, you know, Give Me Novocaine is just – you know, where you self-medicate, whether it's with alcohol or weed or speed or, you know, whatever your drug of choice is, or, you know, it's just kind of falling into that experimenting with, you know, escapism in unhealthy ways. But I think when I was a kid, you know, there was a lot of you know, it was drinking and acid and mushrooms and.
Did you do a lot of acid?
I did my share.
tell me what your trips were like, and whether you saw them as kind of like spiritual, you know, meditative, exploratory things, or whether it was more about music or more about like something else altogether, and whether they were good trips or bad trips.
It kind of depends on the moment of the trip. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the first part of a trip is always is the funnest part.
When you feel it coming on?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. And then there's about the 2 or 3 hours where you're completely confused, and you know, there's certain hallucinations that are happening that I'm not particularly fond of. But then there's the come down, which I always enjoyed also. But the whole experience itself was never really I don't think it ever really contributed to music. I think it cracks open your brain a little bit, but and in the long run, it's and seeing sort of all the casualties around Berkeley and San Francisco because of it, I was always kind of something that was like I never got completely into.
So you never played while you were on acid?
I did. The first time I ever dropped acid, I played with this band called Blatz, and I remember. They were a local band, really crazy. It was like they were basically like the B-52s on acid. There was two female singers, and there was one male singer. The male singer always, this guy Jesse Luscious, always ended up naked on stage. It was a very memorable experience, you know, to see guitar strings that were started kind of wrapping around my neck a little bit. Just like
seems funny now, maybe not so much then.
Well, it wasn't that, but that was part of the downside, that which I didn't when I was coming down, I was like, oh, this is kind of fun, you know, but not really something I ever did with Green Day. Mike and Trey, you know, they definitely did their share of playing. I think we played the Gorge in outside of Seattle, Washington, on Lollapalooza, and they dropped acid then, and that was, you know, an interesting experience to see a rhythm section look at each other and giggle for, 45 minutes.
So the guy who used to take off his clothes while he was performing, could you ever imagine yourself doing that?
Yeah, I did.
You did?
I used to do it a lot. Right after Dookie came out, I was arrested for it in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I did it at Madison Square Garden because I didn't know if I was ever going to play Madison Square Garden again. So I said, well, there's one way to remember this occasion is to be the guy that was naked on stage in Madison Square Garden. And then, you know, and then it came down to a point where it was everywhere we played, the cops started showing up and saying, you know, if this guy gets naked on stage, he's going to be arrested immediately. You know, and sure enough, it happened eventually in Milwaukee.
So what statement were you making by taking all your clothes off?
It was like this non-statement statement, you know. I mean, there was no old enough to know better but too young to care, you know, kind of attitude towards it.
So let's hear another a song, and this is Give Me Novocaine. And mm-hmm. There's a line I particularly like in this, bittersweet migraine in my head. It's like a throbbing toothache of the mind. I like mm-hmm. throbbing toothache of the mind. I think most of us have had a throbbing toothache of the mind.
Yeah.
So Give Me Novocaine reminds me of the Ramones title, I Want to Be Sedated. Were you thinking mm-hmm. about that at all when you wrote it?
No. I mean, that's definitely a kind of poetry that I definitely relate to. You know, a song like Now I Want to Sniff Some Glue or something like that. It's, you know, I think that was a new way of – you know, writing lyrics and just like straight right to the point, you know exactly what's going on.
One of the amazing things about Green Day is that you met Mike Dirnt from the band, mm-hmm. the bass player in middle school. So
yeah,
that's kind
10
of
years
a,
old.
It's kind of amazing, like very few relationships withstand the test of time from middle school to adulthood.
I remember the first conversation we ever had was in, because we ended up in the same class. It was Miss O'Connor's class, and I met Mike pretty much the first week in school, and we, you know, he just ended up coming over to the house all the time, and we just became really close, you know, I think somehow I think sometimes my father dying and Mike coming into my life at the same time sort of coincided. But I think it was around when music really started hitting us both together playing at the same time was around, I think, seventh grade. And we started learning like, heavy metal songs and together and just, you know, jamming together all the time. He'd come over with his guitar and I'd go over to his house with my guitar and it just sort of, you know, lasted till now.
So Trey Cool, who's the drummer with the band, he grew up in an unusual way. He grew up in a home without electricity, no television. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he had radio or probably not mm-hmm. a stereo or anything. I think, stop me if I'm wrong here, that his father was a veteran who wanted to kind of like move away from the world when he got home, and that's why they moved to like a mountain or something. Is that close to?
Yeah, they moved up to the mountains up in Mendocino County, basically like a back to the land kind of family.
Oh, I see.
You
okay.
Know.
Okay.
And I think Trey had a lot of freedom growing up there, and you know, he didn't have a typical childhood at all. You know, I think you know you can. If you talk to him and hang out with him for a while, you would understand that, well, he's not a typical guy at all, you know. He's you know, he ended up playing in a band called The Lookouts. And the first time I ever saw The Lookouts play, he was wearing an old woman's shower cap and he had like a tutu on or something like that, you know. And I remember thinking that he was an amazing drummer. It was a difficult transition going from our old drummer to Trey, just because Trey was just a show off, you know, and so it was kind of. But I knew that the way that he played and the different beats and that background, and because he had a background in jazz and he could play any sort of particular beat or that you wanted. That I knew I could, as a songwriter, I know that I can always write a song that he's going to be able to play immediately. You know, so it kind of opened up my world at the same time.
And when you started touring, Trey's father, your drummer's father, was mm-hmm. was driving. So, yes, or is that incorrect?
Oh yeah. He started. We started touring in 1990. We did the van tours first. This was before Trey's dad came in. So we did 3-4 tours before that, and then when we got a little bit of money together, we bought a bookmobile. But someone needed to have a trucker license to be able to drive this thing. And so Trey's dad knew how to drive it. Or he had the license for it. So he became our driver when we were touring. We opened up for a band called Bad Religion. Then we ended up going on on tour all through the United States again after that in a bookmobile. You know, and that we just converted into this little touring bus.
So did it feel funny to be playing punk music and having one of the band members' fathers having to drive you?
No. I mean, Frank was – Trey's dad was he was one of the guys, you know. There was no rules or anything like that that we had to – you know, that most kids had to abide by. So, you know, we just – it wasn't like he was, you know, he turned into everybody's parent or not. He wasn't even Trey's parent. He was just, you know, he just kind of let us just roam, do whatever the hell we wanted. And you know, and he would go out, we'd go out and get tattoos and he would get a tattoo with us. And he would, you know, it was not really like a typical, he was just, he was someone that you could relate to. And I remember this band Tribe Called Quest would go up and play during Lollapalooza, and there would be these big low end subs that would go out, and it would just shake the entire backstage, and just this really boom, you know. And I remember one time Frank going, "Oh, I don't like that noise," and we're like, "Why is it?" Because that reminds me of dropping napalm in Vietnam, mm. And that was like, "Oh my gosh," you know. So that was a whole different he kind of added a whole different perspective. I mean, he wasn't just Trey's father, but he was just this, I don't know, he was just kind of this cool guy at the same time.
Well, let's hear another song. For this one, we'll go back to Dookie, which won the Grammy for Best Alternative Music Album in 1994. Now, I want to play Basket Case, mm-hmm. which has a line about being neurotic to the bone. can you talk about writing the song?
I remember that song being hard to write. It wasn't an easy song to write, and you know, the lyrics kept changing, and it started out as a relationship song, and then it got the idea for it to be more neurotic and a panic attack song, and it seemed to hit home. And I didn't even expect the song to actually be a single. It was just seemed like it was just a difficult song to play. But then and then it got released, and then, you know, I guess I was wrong about that.
Well, it had a video too.
Yeah. A video of, like, we were in an abandoned insane asylum, you know, and that was pretty heavy to see just all of the different, you know, there would be scratch marks on the walls, people trying to climb out. And it was very like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, kind of moment. It was like, you know, kind of there's the ghosts that were in that place were just it was kind of terrifying, really.
Okay, so this is Basket Case from the Green Day album Dookie.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once? I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid? Am I just sad? I went to a shrink to analyze my dreams. She says it's lack of sex that's bringing me. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me. It all keeps adding up. I think I'm cracking up. Am I just paranoid?
So that's Basket Case from the Green Day album Dookie, and my guest Billy Joe Armstrong is the lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter for the band, and of course now on Broadway is the show American Idiot that's based on the Green Day album of the same name. I'm wondering what it's been like for you to basically become a man on stage. In other words, when you started performing, you were a teenager, you were probably in your 20s when the band started taking off, is that?
Yeah, 22.
Is that right? Yes, that's pretty young. And so, you know, then you became a father, you have two children, so you've grown up a lot since you started performing. But, you know, a lot of your songs are about the questions and the problems of being young, mm-hmm. and of, like, finding your place in the world. But you've kind of found your place. You've grown up. You're the father of two. Do you feel like you've been able to grow and change on stage? You know what I mean? Growing up, like becoming a man in a mm-hmm. public way like that.
Yeah, I think so. It's kind of one of those rare things. I think I've become better at being on stage through the years, especially right around when the record Nimrod hit. I think, you know, especially with big audiences, there's certain things that I had to learn to, you know. I think there's a more of an emotional thing that happens at our show. It's not just about chaos and out of control, and you know, I think it becomes about people dancing and people having a really great time and knowing that I'm responsible for that. So it's it just becomes sort of this gathering, and you see all the, you know, one thing about our shows that what I try to do is to have the dynamics of it. And I'm not just talking about when music gets loud and music gets soft. It's also, I think, like, concerts for me have become about anger. I think they they become about sadness, and then they bring you back to some sort of conclusion, and the crowd feels involved. It's not just about the singer, or it's not just about the band.
Is performing cathartic for you? Do you feel like you undergo some transformation during the course of a concert?
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's a place to die, then I guess on stage would be it's like a lot of people would die in their sleep. I think I would rather die on stage. I just put everything I possibly can into a show, you know, and just make sure that I walk away with the same experience, you know, where I'm not – it's not just about the performance of it, but it's like you sort of guide the audience to, or where, you know, or where the audience has guided me to, you know, at the same time.
Is it ever a problem that life itself isn't as vivid as life on stage can be?
Sometimes it's hard. You know, when you're at home on Sundays and there's not much going on, it becomes a little tough. You know, I think because those are such extreme highs that you go through. It's an addiction, you know, being on stage. So finding those moments, it takes a lot to find those moments of silence, you know. Sometimes it's trying to find moments of silence when you're actually on stage where you look out and you go and you think to yourself, I have to make sure that I'm enjoying every second and just notice that no one is sitting in their seats. You know, everyone is up. And I'm just trying to take it all in, you know. And then when you're at home, it's just trying to take in where it gets really silent and it's like, oh, this is a kind of a mundane experience, you know. And it takes an adjustment. It takes me a week or two to adjust from being, you know, when I get home from tour. I mean, sometimes I think Adrienne, my wife, you know, she's like, you know, I you know, when you come home, why don't you stay at a hotel room for a week or something like that, just for the transition, you know.
Like coming up from the bottom of the ocean and getting the bends or something.
Yeah, totally.
So you met your wife at a Green Day show. Was she a fan?
I don't know if – no, I don't think she was a fan. She was just the girl in Minneapolis that was part of the Minneapolis Mankato punk rock scene. And, you know, she – I met her. We played in a basement and she happened to be there. And then we played at this place called the Varsity in Dinkytown a couple of days later. And she showed up there and everyone we got everyone to come up on stage and start dancing. And she was the only one sitting down in the audience. And she came up to me after because we ran out of we had these EPs that we were selling. And she asked me for an address where she can get one. And then I just gave her my address. And then, you know, we started writing letters back and forth to each other from Minnesota to California.
Oh, interesting. And then you actually started spending time in person together.
Yeah. We were talking on the phone and we were writing letters. And I was just like, I got to go back and see this girl. I haven't seen her since the summer before. And I think it was around spring of 91. And then I had to see her again. So we had this mini tour. It was like five shows. We had to drive all the way out to the Midwest. We played in Beloit, Wisconsin, Sioux Falls. And then we played in Minneapolis and we played in Mankato. And then she showed up in Sioux Falls and then she just grabbed me and she said, Billy Joe. And I turned around and I had to remember what she looked like because I couldn't – it just didn't register at first. But I remember her voice just from the phone. And then she turned and looked at her friend and he goes, he doesn't remember me. And I felt like the biggest tool at that second. I was like, oh my God, I can't – you know. I was like, yes, I do. And so we – I don't know. Then we went to there was a dumpster out in the back and we just talked all night long. And so that was almost 20 years ago.
Dumpster sounds very romantic.
Yeah, well, you know.
and so you were sending real letters to each other, not emails.
No, this was I didn't think I got an email address until about 2 years ago. So we were we were just writing letters and, you know, running up large phone bills.
So I'm thinking about how much you've seen the music industry change. Like you started as this, you know, punk band and an indie band, and now you've got a Broadway show. So I don't know. It seems like you've seen both extremes.
Yeah, it keeps evolving, and I like kind of being on both extremes too. I would never abandon one. You know, I still love playing clubs, and doing these different projects, whether it's something like the Foxborough Hot Tubs or Pinhead Gunpowder or something like that. I still get the same charge out of it, and then putting out EPs and things like that. But I also like the opposite extreme of doing things like rock operas and getting into, you know, musical theater and, you know, and seeing where – what different formats that you can put records out on, whether it's vinyl or a CD or digital download or a video game. So it's – I don't know. And it just keeps changing. You just got to be open to those ideas.
Well, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Billy Joe Armstrong is the lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter for the band Green Day. He's now appearing in the Broadway musical American Idiot, which is based on Green Day's 2004 album. Next month, Green Day will release a new live CD and DVD. It's called Awesome As... Well, I can't say the whole title on the radio, actually. So we'll just leave it at Awesome As F. Here's a track from Green Day's 1994 album Dookie, Welcome to Paradise.
Gunshot rings out at the station. Another urchin snaps and left it on his own. It makes me wonder why I'm still here. But some strange dreams and it's now feeling like I am. And I'm never gonna go.
Two big commercial movies open this week. The Green Hornet is screenwriter and star Seth Rogen's update of the old pulp radio and TV show about a masked hero and his kung fu sidekick. The Dilemma is a comedy starring Vince Vaughn as a man who discovers a secret about the wife of his best friend, played by Kevin James. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of both films.
The Green Hornet and The Dilemma are big-budget male buddy pictures. The first is a semi-satirical action movie. The second, a comedy that turns serious. Both are well-made, and both are tiresome. Folks, the bromance motif, in which grown men wrestle with their masculinity while acting like juveniles, has been wrung dry. The Green Hornet, at least, is likable and a refreshing change from all those heavy, angst-ridden superhero movies. The director is Michel Gondry, of Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, a virtuoso at making childish fantasies take wing. And I'm not the first to notice a Bob Hope, Bing Crosby road movie vibe between the two stars, Seth Rogen as Britt Reed, a.k.a. the Green Hornet, and Jay Chou as the Kung Fu Master Kato, both smitten with Cameron Diaz in the Dorothy L'Amour role. Rogan's Brit is a ne'er-do-well rich kid, son of a disapproving media mogul played by Tom Wilkinson, who dies suddenly. It's all quite Oedipal. In a prologue, the father tears the head off his son's superhero doll, and the Green Hornet persona is born when Brit and Kato, who was his dad's assistant, knock the head off a statue of Brit's father. Their superhero gimmick is that they'll pretend to be bad guys, but really fight criminals. And Britt wants them to be best buds.
We'll need a car.
Hells yes, we'll need a car.
With strong weapons. And armor.
Cool ribs. Spinning rims.
I can do that.
Kato, I want you to take my hand I want you to come with me on this adventure.
I'll go with you, but I don't want to touch you.
Okay, you don't have to take my hand, but will you come with me on this adventure?
The Hope Crosby thing might work better if the quips were fresh and Cho was comfortable with English. He speaks as if he learned it phonetically. And unlike Bruce Lee's Kato in the old TV show, he talks a lot, both for PC reasons and because Cho is a big star in the all-important Asian market. Kato refuses to be Brit's sidekick, so he and Rogan trade lame insults while fighting off the bad guys. There are a few neat trick shots in which Kato moves at different speeds than his slow-mo adversaries, and a couple of good 3D effects, like the split screens in which each frame is at a different spatial level. But it's not worth the 3D glasses surcharge. There's little in The Green Hornet that jumps out at you. But it's the dilemma that really lays there, paralyzed by its seriousness. It's about two unemployed best friends, veterans of the auto industry. Vince Vaughn's Ronnie is a can-do manager, while Kevin James's Nick is the brilliant engineer. Vaughn cooks up a scheme to land a meeting with a big car company, and after it works, they meet up at a crowded bar with Jennifer Connelly as Vaughn's girlfriend, Beth, and Winona Ryder as James's wife, Geneva.
You lying bastard!
You are unbelievable.
Did we get the meeting or not?
I'm hugging this man like I'm some kind of ass.
Why were you hugging the man?
Because he's our guy's direct competitor.
Why would you hug the direct competitor?
Because he had a near-death experience.
Actually, no, he didn't. That never happened. I made that up.
Oh, shame, shame, shame.
What are you doing?
What do you mean, what am I doing? Did we get the meeting or what?
Come on, Nick.
I'm never hugging again. I'm not listening to you, and he sets me up.
What do you expect me to do? Geneva, listen to me. You know him. He's way too honest. If I completely necessary, Nick, my man, we got the meeting.
I'm not going to lie. Sometimes I love your boyfriend.
You, I will
hug you right back.
Come in here.
This is no charge.
Oh, don't ever let me go.
These fleshy guys, one tall, one short and round, have a quintessential manly male project. In a scene that drew considerable advance criticism, Vaughn's Ronnie says of electric cars, they're totally gay, and proposes a new variation, a responsible, energy-efficient car that makes loud vroom-vroom noise like the old Fords and Dodges, like we need more road noise in this world. But the dilemma turns on the women. Ronnie spies Geneva smooching another guy, played by Channing Tatum with a lot of tattoos, and is torn. Should he tell his buddy and shatter him and maybe ruin the project on which everything in their lives rides? Or should he keep it a secret for now? His contortions, moral and physical, occupy the next 90 minutes. Maybe the late Blake Edwards could have found a balance between slapstick and psychodrama, but director Ron Howard can't get the pacing right. Vaughn has a couple of very funny scenes, and Winona Ryder a good demonic glint, but the movie drags, and the central problem, the invention of that noisy engine, ends up a non-issue. The dilemma comes down to whether Ronnie can help Nick recover his masculine pride, symbolized by a scene in a pro hockey arena in which Nick competes to slap a puck into a slot. Even Freud would roll his eyes and tell the filmmakers to grow up.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.